Hello, I'm Jim Falzerano. It's Tuesday, the 14th of April. In today's show, Gordon Brown tries to contain the email sleaze scandal.
There's some evidence that quite a wide circle of people, including serving ministers, knew about this proposal and seemed to be going along with it.
A soldier injured in an ambush in Basra reveals how the conflict affected him as we launch a major new series on the Iraq War.
I could hear them zinging all around me. And Yilin, my gunner, you know, was just like, sir, get back inside. You know, and I remember thinking, actually outside the vehicle is not a good place to be at the moment.
Plus, an exclusive report from Mexico, where a religious cult is accused of harboring drug traffickers.
The Santa Muerta is a cult that is expanding fast because of the conditions of insecurity and violence and the culture of anxiety that Mexicans today are immersed in.
But first, a look at the headlines and today's papers with Bill Overton.
Music producer Phil Spector has been convicted of murdering the actress Lena Clarkson by shooting her at his Los Angeles mansion. A jury in the city spent nearly 9 days deliberating over the case and was won over by the prosecution's claim that the killing was malicious and that the 68-year-old was a demonic maniac. Phil Spector will be sentenced next month and faces at least 18 years behind bars. His lawyers say he'll appeal the decision. Anti-government protesters in Bangkok are being surrounded by hundreds of troops, armoured personnel carriers and barbed wire barricades. There's been an uneasy calm in the Thai capital overnight after two people died yesterday. The Foreign Office is warning against all but essential travel to Bangkok, forcing British tourists to rearrange holiday plans. Supporters of the ousted former Prime Minister Thaksin Shinawatra are concentrated around Government House in the centre of the city. North Korea's announced it'll boycott talks over its nuclear program in protest at UN criticism of its recent rocket launch. The UN Security Council's unanimously condemned the launch, which critics have said could be a test for a long-range missile. North Korea state media says talks over ending its weapons program are useless and it will also restart nuclear facilities, which it had begun dismantling under an international deal. Back home, and Gordon Brown's demanding all political special advisers in Whitehall be summarily dismissed if they're found to be involved in sending out inappropriate material or personal attacks. It follows the resignation of his political aide Damien McBride over revelations of a proposed smear campaign against the Tories. The Prime Minister's still resisting calls for a personal apology, saying he can't say sorry for something he didn't know about. However, he's writing to those concerned to express his regret at what has happened. And a poll by The Guardians found that almost 9 out of 10 climate scientists don't believe political efforts to restrict global warming to 2 degrees Celsius will succeed. They say that given soaring carbon emissions and political constraints, there's more likely to be a rise of 4 to 5 degrees by the end of this century. Such a change would disrupt food and water supplies, kill off thousands of species, and trigger massive sea level rises, which would make millions homeless. Let's take a look at the papers now. And the Times and Telegraph both keep that government email scandal on their front pages. The Times says Gordon Brown's trying to contain the fallout from the allegations by insisting that no other advisor or minister had been involved in Damien McBride's plans. But the Telegraph claims the Prime Minister has now been placed at the centre of the smear campaign against leading Tories after it emerged that he met one of its architects at Chequers shortly after the plot was hatched. And the Financial Times also questions the PM's claims that he knew nothing. The headline there is Brown accused of smokescreen on website smear campaign plan. The Independent leads with a story about unemployment and the cost of insuring against it. Insurers squeeze job loss victims is the front page headline there. The paper says workers who took out insurance against losing their job will now get lower payouts than they originally signed up for, as insurance companies try to cut costs. The Independent claims it's a fresh blow to payment protection insurance, which has been dogged by rampant mis-selling and excessive rates. The Red Tops are on Celebrity Watch on their front pages. The Mirror reports on the latest Hollywood breakup, which could also turn out to be the most expensive ever. Mel's £320 million divorce. The paper says Mel Gibson's wife Robin is divorcing him after 28 years of marriage. And as the couple have no prenuptial agreement, under California law, she'd be entitled to half of his £640 million fortune. Robin wants to split after Mel was apparently pictured on a beach in a clinch with a brunette. The Sun, meanwhile, tells us Jack will crack. The late Jade Goody's husband, Jack Tweed, could face jail today when he goes on trial for attacking a cab driver Friends have told the paper that Jack is close to breaking down after lawyers told him to expect the worst. And finally, the Mail highlights the plight of the downsizers, reporting that record numbers of middle-class homeowners are trying desperately to sell up and move to smaller properties. It says the white-collar recession is really starting to bite, with even high earners facing the prospect of losing both their job and their home. More news and comments throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
Damian McBride, one of Gordon Brown's key advisors, resigned over the weekend following revelations he was involved in an attempt to smear members of the Conservative leadership. Patrick Winter, The Guardian's political editor, explains how damaging the affair has been for Gordon Brown.
Yesterday, after much discussion with his advisers, he has decided to write to the Cabinet Secretary, Scott O'Donnell, to say that he would like the code for special advisers, the code which Damian McBride, his former director of strategy, was supposed to be due to follow. He's asked for that code to be changed and to be tightened up and to make it absolutely clear that it would be an immediate sackable offence if you're found to have been briefing any personal attacks of any kind or any nature, and that it is solely your job to promote the policy of the government. So that this is sort of tightening up of the code for special advisers. He's also separately writing to all the individuals that's been named in the email that Damian McBride sent to Derek Draper, who runs an organisation called Labour List, and in that he named four or five people who intended to smear in various ways, and Gordon Brown's promised he's going to write to those people individually, giving assurance that that it was nothing to do with him, and he deeply regrets what happened. He is also saying in this letter to Gus O'Donnell that he regrets that this event has occurred and that Damian McBride, his former close advisor, has apologised. It's clear also from the briefings being given by Number 10 that Mr. Brown himself is not personally apologising for anything. He doesn't feel he has any need to do so, since he hadn't been aware that these emails were being exchanged between Mr. McBride and Mr. Draper. But that he does feel it lowers the tone of British politics, and that's not what he came into politics to do. So that's his attempt to draw a line under the whole affair.
Sure. Do the Tories smell blood here, or do they think? Does everyone think the scandal's been contained?
Personally, I don't think it is fully contained, because I think there's quite a lot of evidence that there's issues as to who else knew about this email. There are issues as to who knew about the proposal to set up a salacious website on the model of Guido Fawkes, and the salacious website's going to be called Red Rag. There's some evidence that quite a wide circle of people, including serving ministers, knew about this proposal and seemed to be going along with it. So they may have not known about some of the individual ideas for stories that Damian McBride was coming up with, but they knew about the intent to set up this website.
Why do you think that, let's make a comparison with Barack Obama in the United States, who was very successful in generating support, online support for his center-left government or center-left policies. Why do you think Labour's had such a difficult time of it in this country?
I think it's the problem is that this Labour government's been in power for over a decade. They can hardly describe themselves an insurgency bringing change to the country. I mean, they have to offer a different perspective to the country. And so the comparisons with Barack Obama, though they're both on the sort of centre-left, just don't stand up, because they're just in a different position politically in terms of having been an incumbent government for so long. But I don't know whether it's true that this idea that websites can only work if you're in opposition doesn't seem to me particularly true. I mean, I think you can write an intelligent centre-left website even when you're in government. But I think the problem that the a lot of the Labour high command have come up with is that they seem to be wanting to run these websites themselves rather than letting them develop organically, which is why there's been success on the right. There's most of the best websites are ones that are not associated directly with the Conservative Party. They have conservative leanings, although Guido Fawkes could be arguably characterised as an anti-politics website. The Conservative Home and other effective websites on the right are independent of the Conservative Party. The foolish mistake that Labour seems to be making is to try to run them in a semi-official capacity.
Sure. One more question. How does the public engage with this sort of scandal? Is this a Westminster affair, or is this something that the general public is really going to take note of?
I think the public public will take note of the fact that on taxpayers' money, people are preparing this kind of smear against another political party. I mean, I think, you know, there's always rough and tumble in politics, but the degree to which this was going on will shock people. And I think what's also worrying and must be unnerving for Gordon Brown is the degree to which there will be people in the Labour ranks who will start to dredge up memories of how they feel they were mistreated by Damien McBride, who is certainly one of the toughest operators in the Westminster Village, and many of them claim they've been victims of his briefings. Whether that's true or not, they often assume he has been, and there's at least five or six cabinet ministers who I could cite, who, you know, hate Damien McBride with a vengeance. And the danger is it could reopen all these old wounds between the Blairites and the Brownites, and the way in which Gordon Brown took power from Tony Blair, where there was a very sustained briefing war against Tony Blair in the run-up to that.
That was Patrick Winter, and there's more on that story at guardian.co.uk/politics. Also on The Guardian's website today, Kevin McCarra on Chelsea's resurgence under new boss Gus Hiddink. That's at guardian.co.uk/football. Our legal affairs editor, Afua Hirsch, argues that Britain needs a fully independent police force at guardian.co.uk/commentisfree. And gay literature has fallen afoul of Amazon's sales ranking system. Find out more at guardian.co.uk/technology. This autumn, the British government is set to announce a long inquiry into the Iraq War. However, the committee is unlikely to report until after the next election. The issue is politically charged, as according to polls, thousands of Labour voters have deserted the party, citing the war as a principal reason. This week, The Guardian is running a series in print and online looking at all aspects of the conflict. Today, we hear from Major David Bradley, whose injuries, sustained in a Basra ambush in 2004, forced him to retire from the army.
I was a soldier. I got blown up. Shit happens. For as long as I remember, at my youngest age, I wanted to be a tractor driver because I grew up on a farm. And until my great aunt gave me a packet of toy soldiers at 4 or 5. And from that point onwards, I wanted to join the army, be a soldier. So 9th of August 2004 towards the latter half of our tour, and sat within a period of high tension within Basra and southern Iraq in general. I just sat down to have my pie and chips when the runner came in from the back of the box room saying, "Sir, you're needing the ops room, there's been an incident, get back in there." So I'm looking at my pie and chips and thinking, I really want this, but having to get up and leave it half eaten and getting as fast as possible into the ops room to find out what the problem was. And Prenti, who was the ops officer, put his finger in the centre in the map, which was the centre of this out of bounds area, and said, "By the Ba'ath Party headquarters." And we both looked at each other, and I remember saying, "What the fuck are they doing in there?" As soon as we crossed that line, RPG swung on for fire, you know, from the buildings on the left-hand side. So I then started to far manoeuvre the vehicles down, which is one, keeping firm, providing fire while the rest move. And as we were doing that, I got the last message I got from the battalion 2IC, actually, who got on the net and just said, "Be aware, it is confirmed that British soldiers are now cut off in the centre of Basra. You are to use all means at your disposal to get them back," which focused the mind somewhat. And I was looking for insurgents, trying to identify the fire. I could hear the fire, and you could see the fire coming in. I couldn't see exactly where they were. One of the concerns was on the left-hand side, the vehicles, they were really low, but they were quite high, and they had used the rooftops before. And I remember having looked from right, scanning my rifle and looking up on these rooftops just to check there was no one up there as we were coming down that way. And as I was coming back, I just remember, I didn't hear a bang, but I just felt a pressure and remember being pushed over to one side of the cupola and looking down and seeing a thick, dark, grey explosion. And just at the time thinking, that looks bad. At the same time, I remember sort of my hand being flung up and just seeing it covered in blood and seemed to be split in half like a cloven hoof around the area of my index finger and my thumb. And then being aware that I was on fire on my body armour, trying to get onto the internal comms to say, "Lads, get out, you know, RPG in the turret, you know, evacuate." Unbeknown to me, the explosions had been, you know, we'd been hit by 6 to 8 RPGs and the combined explosions had cut all the communication, so no one could hear me. But I said it, and then myself clambered out onto the top of the turret with my one good hand and lay on the top. And as my mind cleared, and I was just suddenly very conscious of the bullets pinging off the and whipping, as they have a particular noise as they come past, and I could hear them zinging all around me. And Yilin, my gunner, was just like, "Sir, get back inside. And I remember thinking, actually, outside the vehicle is not a good place to be at the moment. Couldn't talk to anyone. He could hear Yilin firing. When he looked back up the tunnel as Yilin was traversing the turret, he could see me sitting in a pool of blood and thought I was dead, but just knew he had to get back to get me back to a doctor as soon as possible. So he accelerated the vehicle, which was fortunate because it turns out that the insurgents were realising that they'd hit us quite badly. We're trying to advance and try and capture us. Some lads with a stretcher turned up, and I remember just collapsing back in the stretcher and just thinking, I'm not going to get back up from this. And they say when I got in there that I was so badly wounded that if there had been anyone else coming in, they'd have triaged me and put me to one side and let me die because they'd have more chance of saving someone else. And actually the doctor who operated on me gave me a 5% chance of survival. I just left intensive care and I got a letter on a Majesty's service in a brown envelope from the military. It was a fill-in-the-blank letter, which was, "Dear Major Bradley, you are now on the Y list, which is where you're put, which is an administrative action to take you off away from your battalion to allow them to replace you, but you'll still get paid and you're still in the army. You're now part of the Y list. You're no longer part of your battalion. Do not contact them for administrative support. Please come through us." And it was just a real kick, because you desperately want to be part of your unit. I was very proud of B Company, very proud of, my regiment. And it was clear that I couldn't soldier on. And I was medically discharged. And I suddenly became Mr. Bradley.
And you can follow our interactive series all week at guardian.co.uk/Iraq. Still to come on Guardian Daily, Joe Tuckman reports from Mexico City on the cult of Santa Muerte and their public protests against the government. But first, the violent demonstrations that have turned deadly in Thailand are but the latest unrest to hit a country that has already seen more than its share of military coups. Mark Tran, who writes on foreign affairs for Guardian.co.uk, explains the violence and the political split that has created it.
I think the immediate roots of the protests go back to the military coup in 2006 that overthrew the former Prime Minister, Thaksin Shinawatra. He represents rural interests. He's a populist figure, and he mobilized the rural vote and came into power on those votes. And in reaction to his efforts to upset the status quo, if you like, the military threw him out in 2006. And his supporters basically feel that they've been robbed of political power, hence the protests.
How serious have these protests become?
Well, they were very bad at the weekend because there was going to be a regional summit, a summit bringing Asian leaders to talk about the effects of the global crisis and what to do. And the present Prime Minister decided to take a hands-off attitude, and it backfired badly because the protesters basically took over the centre where the summit was going to be held in a deeply humiliating series of events. Foreign leaders, some of them had to be helicoptered out to safety because the troops said they couldn't guarantee their safety, and the summit was cancelled. So in the past day, the authorities obviously decided to take a hard line, and they sent in troops to crack down on the protesters. And now they are closing in on what seems to be a hard core of about 5,000 protesters who have been encamped around the Prime Minister's office since the end of last month.
Is there any evidence that Shinawatra is orchestrating these protests, or are these just his supporters acting on their own?
Well, he did send a message to the protesters when they were demonstrating before the summit. He actually said it was time to have a revolution, to go out in the streets and have a revolution. And he said he was ready to come back to the country. So he is stirring the pot, if you like.
Well, will we see yet another military coup?
Well, after 2006, when the military threw out Thaksin, they assumed power. But the experience was a difficult one. They realized that operating in the political sphere is very difficult, and they withdrew to barracks. And there has been speculation that the reason they've been vacillating is that they do not really want to have another coup where they have to be put in a position of having to deal with an economy that's probably the most badly hit in Asia from the global crisis. They're simply not equipped to deal with such matters. And so they would quell the riots, demonstrations, but they'd be very reluctant to take over unless it's a last resort to prevent the country from sliding into anarchy.
That was Mark Tran. The Mexican cult of Santa Muerte, or Saint Death, has attracted a growing number of followers, including many drug traffickers. When the Mexican army destroyed some of the cult's shrines in an attempt to intimidate the traffickers, mass protests erupted. Joe Tuckman reports from Mexico City.
The sound of the bells of Mexico City's cathedral during Holy Week mixes with the chants of protesters from one of Mexican Catholicism's most uncomfortable offshoots, the rapidly expanding cult of La Santa Muerte, or Saint Death. "We are believers, we are not criminals," they chant, angry at the demolition by soldiers last month of 35 Santa Muerte chapels near the northern border. They were bulldozed because of the cult's association with drug traffickers.
"We want the people of Mexico and the world to understand who the followers of the Santa Muerte are, and that we are not the criminals that they say we are. She has done many miracles for us all, myself included."
Santa Muerte priest David Romo called the faithful to protest on Palm Sunday, Good Friday and Easter Sunday in the name of religious freedom, warning of a holy war if the acts of repression against the Santa Muerte cult continue. His is actually a notably tame faction within the cult that, aside from attracting the odd drug lord, holds particular appeal to the masses of Mexicans who live on the fringes of danger and legality, as religious scholar Bernardo Barranco explains.
"The Santa Muerte is a cult that is expanding fast because of the conditions of insecurity and violence and the culture of anxiety that Mexicans today are immersed in. This translates into a state of mind and a search for explanations and identity, and the Santa Muerte offers these to large sectors of the population, to people who have been excluded from the system of globalization and modernization, and who find in the Santa Muerte a way of explaining their lives."
The Santa Muerte is usually represented as a female version of the Grim Reaper. Sometimes she has long flowing robes, sometimes a crown, often dollars are stuck to her clothing. Devotees rarely go anywhere without some personal image with them. It could be a tiny amulet around their neck or a tattoo across their back. On the first march, a motley collection of adepts from the hardest barrios of the capital walked through the centre of town, carrying their statues with them. They also carried stories of miracles done and favours wanted equally close to their hearts. Sergio Hernandez, a 24-year-old toilet cleaner, remembers how his faith became unshakable when he was found innocent of car stealing.
"I thought I was going to be in jail for some time, so I started to ask my skinny one, the Santísima Muerte, for the chance to be out in the street again, and that's what happened. When the verdict came, they said I was free. These are things that make you really, truly believe in her." "Everything good in my life, I owe to her and to God."
Fernando Ramirez, with his bright green gelled Mohican and his impressive tattoos, carried an image made by his brother in jail. He credited the Santa Muerte for keeping food on his children's plate as the economic crisis sets in.
The truth is that right now, the miracle that Santa Muerte has done for me is to keep me in work, and that is why we're here. That's why we're devoted to her, because we can ask her for what we really need, and she delivers.
As well as miracles performed, devotees of the Santa Muerte again and again stress that she does not discriminate. They mean it in the sense that she excludes no one from her congregation, whether because of their dress code or their morality, but also in the sense that in the end, no one can escape that final close encounter. For Isidro Pastrana, a cross-dressing cook who went on the march carrying a papier-mâché scythe, this, in the end, is the most important thing about the cult.
We believe in God first, and after God the Santa Muerte, because death exists, and one day, whether you believe in her or not, she will come for you.
That was Joe Tuckman. This podcast was produced by Phil Maynard. I'm Jim Falzarano. Thanks for listening.